The allegations in a criminal investigation being conducted by the United States Attorney's Office, Southern District of New York, and the Federal Bureau of Investigations are troubling to all of us. While the investigation is continuing and no charges have been filed against the University of Louisville or any of its employees, the allegations are serious.
That's the University of Louisville's interim president talking about the Hall of Fame men's basketball coach, Rick Pitino. He's out, not fired, just on unpaid leave for now. Just one of the many shoes that are dropping all over college basketball. Yesterday, the FBI arrested four assistant basketball coaches, including Tony Bland from USC. They're charged with crimes including bribery, conspiracy, and wire fraud. Acting U.S. Attorney June Kim said coaches received hundreds of thousands of dollars for steering players to financial advisors, agents, and sportswear companies.
They knew that the corrupt coaches, in return for bribes, would pressure the players to use their services. And they also knew that if and when those young players turned pro, that would mean big bucks for them.
Well, Matt Money Smith is co-host of the Petros and Money Show on AM 570. He's here now. Hi there.
Hi, Mel. How are you?
I wonder if you're thinking of changing your name now.
You know what? It's always been a bit of a problem.
Okay, so let's talk first about Rick Pitino. So this is a big story because he is the highest paid basketball coach in the country at, what, more than $7 million a year. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame. What is his alleged involvement in this scandal?
Well, this is the old straw that broke the camel's back cliche, right? Coach Pitino is arguably one of the greatest. I mean, just from a coaching standpoint, one of the greatest coaches to have ever been a part of college basketball, whether it was a Final Four run at Providence with a ragtag group or championships at Kentucky or at Louisville, where he won a championship as well. This is one of the all-time greats. I mean, and some would argue the greatest coach in college basketball history. But he's been marred by scandal. And at Louisville, this is now number three. You know, there was one where it was his illicit affair and an extortion attempt, and that got really ugly. The second one was, I mean, it was a pseudo brothel that he was running on campus where he was bringing in prostitutes for recruits when they came to visit. And now this. So,
wow.
You know, maybe one, all right, he's too good of a coach. Two, we're a little nervous. Three, that's it. They say he's on leave, but he's done.
Okay, so are they saying that he actually knew that this was going on or that he directed it or anything like that?
You know, what happened in the last couple years, because you have this, you know, this very popular phrase in college athletics of plausible deniability, and it's not just in college athletics, but that's what would happen is you would pin it on an underling, you would fire them and say, see, we've cut out our problem. They're now out of the program. Our bad. We did not know. Shame on us for not knowing. Now please leave us alone. We'll move ahead with our big head coach here. They're not saying that's not the case. The head coach is responsible for the entire program. The athletic director is responsible for the entire athletic program, and you cannot file, you know, you cannot claim plausible deniability anymore. So that's what Rick Pitino was trying to do yesterday. He released a statement where he said, this is shameful. I know University of Louisville was complicit here, but we're going to find out who these bad actors were. That was the word that he used, the phrase, bad actors, and eliminate them. And the university said, no, that's not going to work this time.
Okay, what about these other colleges, including USC? As I said, Tony Bland is out. He's the associate head basketball coach. What about his boss?
Yeah, it's interesting, Madeline, because right now this is a federal problem. This is not the NCAA. The NCAA they really are toothless. They have not had a good run of coming down and laying sanctions and discouraging programs from this type of behavior just because they, A, aren't interested in it because it's a $1 billion business, and the last thing they want to do is shut down marquee programs like Louisville or USC football, and B, they just don't have the manpower. So this is the feds. I mean, these folks are, you know, looking at jail time, and they haven't even started talking yet. So we don't know what's going to happen to USC until Tony Bland gets with the FBI, knows what he's been charged with, what he's facing, and how I guess forthcoming he's going to be with his answers there. And then that begins the NCAA's process because they're just going to pick up where the feds leave off. They don't have the manpower the feds do to figure out exactly what happened and who knew what.
So could there be more federal charges then, maybe against Andy Enfield, his boss?
I don't know about Andy. I mean, I think in terms of the basketball program,
yeah.
You know, this is a program that got in trouble, you know, about a decade ago with O.J. Mayo, where it was, you know, the literal sack of cash to come play for us that it was mm-hmm. exchanged, you know, and that was one issue. So if USC, again, is part of some sort of conspiracy or involved in behavior that they shouldn't be in amateur athletics, the NCAA is probably going to come down really hard on them. And whether or not Andy Enfield can escape that, I doubt, because like I said, they hold head coaches responsible for all their assistants. And a lot of it, though, I think will be predicated on what Tony Bland has to say to the feds when learning of what he's facing in terms of federal charges.
Well, as you say, this is a billion-dollar business, and these are amateur athletes. They're not supposed to be paid. But this money is swilling around the whole system. Obviously, bribery is illegal, actual cash for services. But how has the NCAA been kind of skirting around this over the years?
Well, it's not necessarily that they're skirting it. They're just ignoring it. It's, you know, you said $1 billion business. Yeah, you know, college athletics is $1 billion business. But shoes is a multi-billion-dollar business. You know, I mean, and you just look at the news today, right? And anybody that follows the market knows that Nike took a big hit today, and that Adidas is making up ground here in the States and in Europe, and that's a big deal for one of the widely held stocks in the world of retail and apparel. So when you have, I don't know.
And we should note that the head of marketing for Adidas is involved in this,
exactly.
is accused in this scandal.
So that's who went down. That was actually the biggest name. Well, now Rick Pitino's the biggest name. But prior to that, that was the biggest name in all of that. This was this high-level executive that had been with Adidas for 20 years. And you're talking about millions of dollars, they say, exchanging hands of him trying to steer kids to Adidas school. So UCLA is now an Under Armour school. I'm sure you remember that story that mm-hmm. they got a $200 million to wear Under Armour. So you have executives that want to see the best high school players in their gear. And that's where all this money is coming from. It's coming from the shoe companies in steering the best players to the schools that wear their shoes, be it a Nike school at USC or an Under Armour school at UCLA. And they used to be an Adidas school, which got a lot of people here in Los Angeles wondering about the UCLA program, since it was a high-level Adidas executive that was sending these kids to these programs, and UCLA was an Adidas school up until last year.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And so you're thinking that perhaps it's not just these four assistant basketball coaches, it's a whole bunch more?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite quotes that I read yesterday was from an unnamed college head coach that said, I know I'm going to sleep like a baby tonight, but I know a lot of my contemporaries aren't.
Yeah.
And that suggests that, yes, this is just, you know, I would assume the feds are not going to put 2 years into this in a federal probe and involve the FBI if there isn't more than just four assistant coaches, one executive, and a couple unnamed universities and players. I've got to believe that this is going to be a big, it'll end up, in my opinion, being the biggest scandal in college athletics history. I mean, on par with point shaving, all of those things. This one's going to end up being really, really big.
Matt Money Smith, co-host of the Petros and Money Show. You can hear it on AM 570. Matt, thank you.
You got it. Anytime.
All right, we're going to look at UC Irvine now. Don't worry, Anteater fans, your team has not been implicated in the basketball scandal. We're going to talk about this month's $200 million gift to UCI's medical school and the controversy that has generated. The money, the seventh largest donation to a single American university, will be used to build the Samueli College of Health Sciences. It's going to house the medical school, nursing, a future pharmacy, and public health program. Here's the catch. The Samuelis, who made their money in tech, are big believers in homeopathy and other non-traditional forms of medicine. Much of that treatment is unproven, and that has put UCI in an interesting position. Business columnist Michael Hiltzik has been reporting this for the LA Times, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi.
All right. The headline on your column is $200 million donation threatens to tar UC Irvine's medical school as a haven for quacks. A haven for quacks? How so?
Well, as you pointed out, the Samuelis are big believers in homeopathy, naturopathy, and other, you call it non-traditional treatments. Others call them unproven. Some of them have been debunked, including homeopathy. And by accepting this money, UCI is basically exposing itself to the chance that it's going to start steering some of that money to these unproven and debunked treatments. And that's a real danger. It's something that I think the UCI administration is going to have to keep a very close eye on. But the signs from the past have not been encouraging because they've gotten money from the Samuelis before and used it for these treatments.
Mm. And you noted that the university took the word homeopathy off its website recently.
That's right. I wrote about that, yes.
So what does that say to you?
Well, I think it's hard to know because the university hasn't said why it did that or whether that indicates that it's no longer going to be offering these sorts of treatments or simply no longer advertising it. But I think at the very least it suggests that the university has reason to be embarrassed about the fact that homeopathy, which is one of these modes of treatment that has been proven not to work, it's proven quackery, to offer these treatments under its imprimatur, under its name, that's a big problem for UCI because it's supposed to be a medical school. It says it's devoted entirely to science-based medicine. Homeopathy is the antithesis.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what homeopathy is and why it has been so thoroughly debunked. And the idea behind homeopathy is that like treats like, right? And this comes from a German doctor from the 1700s who had this idea that if you're sick with something, you should treat the illness with a version of that sickness so that it fires up the body's immune system. So how has that and why has that been debunked?
Well, you're exactly right. The idea behind modern homeopathy, if we could call it modern, is, as you said, like treats like. You're supposed to be given treatments and substances that create or inspire the same symptoms as you're suffering with. And the idea is that these homeopathic remedies and nostrums are so diluted that there's really almost nothing left of the substance that causes these symptoms. But somehow the water that's used to dilute them remembers what was in them originally, and therefore these remedies will have some effect. Homeopathy is one of these non-traditional or alternative medicines that's been subjected to rigorous testing. And these trials have shown beyond a shadow of a doubt that it simply does not work. It's a nostrum. It's basically snake oil. And yet here's UCI offering these treatments to patients at its UCI health clinics.
But what about the idea? I mean, they're calling it integrative medicine, and they're sort of saying that this idea of treating the whole body needs to be taught in medical schools, that we have become too focused in our so-called Western medicine on treating just single organs that fail or, you know, diseases after they've manifested and not in preventative medicine or in treating the whole body and using things like meditation or yoga to relieve stress, and that could actually help cure a sick person.
Sure. You see, that's one of the problems with this claim about so-called integrative medicine. It's a combination of truth and fiction, and we would include acupuncture in that. There's no double-blind, well-designed, thorough study that establishes that acupuncture actually works for some of the things that it's being used for. It's often advertised as an ancient Chinese remedy as though that should give it some credibility, but that's not science. And that's what a lot of doctors who are concerned about the incursion of these other therapies into real medicine are concerned about.
Okay, so what happens next? Does UCI have a public relations problem on its hands, or does it just hope that this controversy quietly goes away and it can keep the money?
Well, I think that UCI does have at least a public relations problem on its hands, and it may actually have an operational problem on its hands, and it all depends on the influence that the Samueli family is going to have on what it offers and how it offers and how it teaches. This $200 million grant, most of it is going to go to hiring 15 endowed endowed professors. The question is, who's going to choose them? How are they going to be chosen? Are they going to be encouraged to push and promote these sorts of untested remedies, or are they really going to just stick to pure science, as UCI says? The spotlight is really going to be on the university because the donors are very intense promoters of these unproven and debunked therapies. And I think that's a big problem for UCI. It's going to have to be very careful going forward about how it spends its money, who it hires for its program, how it hires these people, and who's got real influence about what it's teaching.
Michael Hiltzik, he is a business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, how the Republican Party defines itself in the age of Donald Trump and Roy Moore, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A shiver went through the Republican Party establishment last night when evangelical firebrand Roy Moore won the Republican Senate primary in Alabama. The GOP leadership, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, went all in. They spent millions to support the incumbent, Luther Strange. President Trump visited Alabama and campaigned for Strange. But Moore, the controversial former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, won handily. In his victory speech last night, he said there were no hard feelings.
We can support the president. Don't let anybody in the press think that because he supported my opponent that I do not support him and support his agenda. As long as it's constitutional, as long as it advances our society, our culture, our country, I will be supportive. But we have to return the knowledge of God and the Constitution of the United States to the United States Congress.
Okay, so what does this mean for the upcoming midterms and for the Republican Party? Kevin Robillard covers campaigns for Politico. He's here now. Hi.
Great to be on.
All right, so this is a guy who was removed from his position on the Alabama Supreme Court twice, the latest for refusing to implement the Supreme Court's decision legalizing gay marriage. Mm-hmm. Why is he so popular in Alabama?
Because he was willing to do things that got him removed from his own state Supreme Court twice.
For those reasons, okay.
Yeah, for those reasons. I mean, he is not someone, some of these other GOP insurgents of recent years have sort of come out of nowhere or not been career politicians. Moore very much is. He's been an assistant state's attorney, hold a number of different sort of judicial positions over the years, including there's two stints on the Alabama Supreme Court, both of which ended with him getting ousted for refusing to obey a federal court order. And really, he just has a brand as sort of an outsider and as sort of, you know, someone with a generally, you know, blow it all up sort of approach, not unlike Trump. So even though he didn't have Trump's endorsement, a lot of Trump supporters, you know, could see him as a kindred spirit to the president.
Yeah, and the president then deleted his tweets in support of Luther Strange. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about what this means for the party, the bigger picture, and Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader, because, as we said, he went all in. He spent millions, or his funds spent millions, to support Luther Strange. And he was pretty much an object of ridicule in Moore's campaign. What does this mean for Mitch McConnell? And if Moore is to win in the general in December, what does it mean for him and his caucus?
I mean, look, straight up, this is not someone Mitch McConnell wanted to be a senator. They believe that Moore will be sort of a problem child, so to speak, in the Senate. They think he will constantly sort of make remarks that the Republican Party at writ large will be held accountable for. You know, a lot of people compared him to Todd Akin, the Missouri congressman who famously talked about, you know, legitimate rape, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people didn't necessarily mean that in that he would blow the chance at winning the Senate seat in Alabama, they meant it as that he'll say things that that will damage the Republican Party's brand nationally. And he also, the other thing you have to remember is one senator can cause a lot of problems in a way a single member of the United States House cannot. One senator, a lot of the things the Senate does rely on unanimous consent, basically, you know, just sort of moving throughout the business of the Senate, bringing up bills, stuff like that. If one senator withholds consent, you know, it can really throw off the timeline they have for doing, you know, pretty much everything. And they're really afraid that Moore is the type of guy who's going to throw up a lot of roadblocks, create filibusters, create government shutdowns, stuff like that.
Wow. Okay. Well, Steve Bannon showed up at Moore's victory party, and this is what he had to say.
You're going to see in state after state after state, people that follow the model of Judge Moore, that do not need to raise money from the elites, from the crony capitalists, from the fat cats in Washington, D.C., New York City, Silicon Valley. The question was called today in the state of Alabama. Who's sovereign? The people or the money? And Alabama answered today, the people.
Okay, so is this just an Alabama race, or is this a foreshadowing of what's to come in 2018?
So Steve Bannon certainly plans on it, continuing on into 2018. One thing I'd be careful about doing here is not overinterpreting Bannon's influence. Bannon basically came in with a month left in this race and endorsed a candidate who was already well ahead in Roy Moore. And then now it's sort of trying to take credit for his win. Bannon wants, and certainly there is evidence that he's succeeding in sort of creating some momentum out of this. He would like to see candidates in the style of Moore win in places like Tennessee and Mississippi and Nevada and Arizona. These are all states with incumbent Republican senators that a Bannon-style candidate might challenge. The good thing for Republicans, at least establishment Republicans, is that the amount of damage something like that can do is somewhat limited this cycle, if only because Democrats are defending a lot more seats in the Senate than Republicans are. Democrats are defending 25 seats. Republicans are only defending 8. But this could be a problem if these candidates also win, for example, in a state like Missouri, where there's a Democratic Senator, Claire McCaskill, that Republicans would really much like to beat. Whether or not this momentum can continue is sort of an open question. Certainly Bannon, has some claim on Trump's brand, so to speak, and Bannon also has a powerful ally and conservative donor, Robert Mercer. But the establishment Republicans have plenty of money, and really they've gotten pretty good before today, or before last night, in defeating these types of primary challenges. They lost a lot in 2010 and 2012, but in 2014 and 2016, establishment Republicans basically ran the table in these sort of Senate primaries.
Okay, and finally, any chance at all that the Democrat wins in December in Alabama?
The way I would put it is if a Republican can win in Massachusetts in 2010, it's maybe possible for a Democrat to win in Alabama in 2017. This would be very, very difficult. It would be an upset of seismic proportions. But that said, Doug Jones, the Democratic candidate there, has a very good biography. He is likely to be able to raise a pretty good amount of money online. The tough thing about Alabama is that it is a very racially polarized electorate. The state is, there's a huge number of black Democrats and a larger number of white Republicans, and there's not too much crossover between the two. And so it's very difficult for a Democrat to win enough of the white vote to win the state overall. But if Jones can somehow pull that off, he would basically need to do this by arguing that Moore's brand of social conservatism would be bad for business, would be bad for the state's economy, would make the state look bad. That seems to be the argument he's going with. Then maybe he does have a chance. But like I said, it would be a tremendous, tremendous upset.
All right. Kevin Robillard, reporter for Politico, thanks so much.
Great to be on.
Coming up, when Jennifer Brea first started experiencing bizarre symptoms, people thought it was all in her head until she started filming herself on her phone and showed the footage to her doctor.
And he turned white, and suddenly he was like, oh my gosh, you need a spinal tap, you need an MRI. I don't know what is wrong, but something seriously wrong is happening.
She turned her quest to understand her disease into a movie and discovered that millions of others suffer the same thing. We're going to talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Jennifer Brea was 28 years old, engaged, working on her PhD at Harvard, when she came down with a fever. She thought it was maybe just a flu, except she never got better. She would sometimes fall from exhaustion just from trying to walk and then become completely bedridden. Jennifer was eventually diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, an autoimmune disease that has mystified scientists and the public for decades. But chronic fatigue syndrome affects some 17 million people worldwide. Jennifer Brea chronicles all this in her documentary. It's called Unrest, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us about the first time you went to the hospital after you began to experience these symptoms. What did they tell you?
So the first time I went to the hospital, I started to lose the ability to write or read or speak or think. And I went in and was told essentially that either I was just having a migraine or that there was nothing really wrong with me at all. And I was referred to a neurologist who eventually diagnosed me with conversion disorder, which is the modern day name for hysteria.
Hysteria, which is an age-old, you know, illness that people said that women were afflicted with. It came from their uterus, right?
Yeah.
So what did you think? I mean, it sounds almost like an Alfred Hitchcock movie where you're being gaslighted, where you know that you're feeling these symptoms, and yet everyone's saying you're not feeling anything. It's all in your head.
So I got sick after a high fever. And basically, after the fever broke, I started getting really dizzy and walking into door frames and started having these symptoms that I couldn't even describe because I had never experienced anything like that before.
My right side of my face feels numb. I feel like my brain is misfiring. Sometimes I have these strange little moments where, like, my hand will make a fist and then I can't open it.
Sometimes I wouldn't be able to speak.
Wow. Wow.
I would be sensitive to light, and the slightest sound could cause excruciating pain. And I think, you know, I think for me, it was a really frustrating and isolating experience not to have a diagnosis in those early days and to be told essentially that either I wasn't really sick at all or that it was in my head. And it never occurred to me that that wasn't enough, that my own story about my body wasn't enough to be believed.
And if you could just talk a little bit about why you decided to make a movie about this. I mean, this is a very personal movie. You turn your phone, I guess, on you as you're going through some of these attacks. I mean, it's very harrowing to witness you just incapacitated by this illness. Why did you want to make a movie about it?
Soon after becoming bedridden, I lost the ability to read or write. Like, if I tried to write a single sentence of an email, I would pass out for 4 hours from the exertion. And so I was always someone who kept a diary, and not being able to, you know, use a pen and paper, I turned to my iPhone. And I remember this one time I was in a doctor's office and I was telling him, you know, last night I was totally collapsed on the floor and I couldn't lift my head and I didn't have the strength to call out. And I was trying to describe to him these symptoms, and he didn't even look at me as I was sort of using these words. And so I took my phone out and I showed him this video. It's actually, you know, some of the opening shots in the film. And I said, no, look, this is what happened last night.
don't know what I did to myself. I don't think I can get up off the couch.
And he turned white, and suddenly he was like, oh my gosh, you need a spinal tap, you need an MRI. I don't know what is wrong, but something seriously wrong is happening. And so it gave me the sense that, you know, the visual image was a really important part of telling a story where words fail.
I know you might be saying to yourself, if I really couldn't stand up, why would I be filming it? Well, I kind of think that someone should see this.
And so that's how I knew that it had to be a film. And I had this belief, and I still do, that if we could bring people inside of this experience of what it is to have this disease and what it is to live with a chronic illness, that we could start to change things. That by bringing you into our homes and bedrooms, you could understand this experience from the inside, and we could build, you know, a sense of compassion and recognition for the patients who are dealing with us.
And so you do a lot of research on the chronic fatigue, or whatever it was called in the past, and you find out that there was actually an outbreak of it in the 1980s, right, in Nevada?
A mystery disease has struck the town of Incline Village, Nevada, a disease for which doctors have no cure.
Doctors have diagnosed more than 200 cases of the same illness in this area.
Yes, there's actually been about 70 outbreaks that have been recorded in medical journals stretching back to the 30s. So there's a long, long history of these sort of cluster outbreaks. And there was a big one in the 1980s in Incline Village, Nevada.
An epidemic of apparent mono in a girls' basketball team. And by July, August, we had over 200 cases of adult viral-like syndrome. We were certain we were looking at something that we had never, ever heard of before.
And, you know, the disease had sort of been forgotten for about a decade, at least in the U.S., until that outbreak, and it created a lot of new interest and sort of news coverage of the disease, but also from that came this name, chronic fatigue syndrome.
The chronic fatigue syndrome. It's been called the yuppie flu, Epstein-Barr, and a living hell by those who suffer from it.
There's still no adequate medical explanation for it. The experts say it could be triggered by viruses.
We all get tired, but is it chronic fatigue syndrome? Some believe that's a made-up condition.
And that really has been, I think, a large part of why this disease has been so neglected and marginalized. You know, fatigue is something that's almost too familiar. We all, you know, get tired from time to time. But this is a disease that's qualitatively different. It's sort of, you know, you experience this thing that's called post-exertional malaise, which is basically like having a metabolic speed limit. And if you go beyond your limit, you know, you might end up crashing in bed for days, weeks, months, you know, unable to even move or lift your head.
So it's been about 5 years or more, 5.5 years since you were diagnosed or since you fell ill?
I had a really high fever that triggered this journey, for lack of a better word, when I was 28, and now I'm 34 years old.
And there's some really moving moments in your movie where you and your husband are, you know, in this intimate moment, and you're saying, how can I do this to you? I can't be a proper wife to you. And I guess I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, about how he has coped with this and how he has had to struggle with your illness.
So, I mean, I think on my side, I have felt a lot of guilt about the fact that he's not sick, and yet he has to live this with me and walk this with me and lose out potentially on his dreams and his freedom, like the freedom that people who are healthy and able-bodied have. And so I struggled with that a lot at the beginning, and it's a conversation that we still have. And I think what he always says to me is, you know, we are irreplaceable to each other, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't, you know, wave a wand and make a totally different life if I could. He, for a very long time, was taking care of me day in, day out, you know, waking up, making breakfast, making all my meals, doing all the laundry.
What's impossible to capture is just how hard this is day in, day out. It's hard to like go on Facebook and see friends having kids, raising kids. I just feel like our lives are frozen in this kind of sickness amber.
I mean, I think the thing that's really hard is that, you know, when we first met and started dating and decided to get married, we had this vision of this really big life, and we wanted to be able to travel together and, you know, go out and, you know, spend time with friends and visit family and start our own family. And we've had to, I think, I wouldn't say that we've given up on those dreams, but that this disease forces you to make really conscious choices about how you spend your time, because, you know, there's just less available, less life available, less energy available. You know, we went to celebrate our fifth wedding anniversary last week, and I was able to go out for 3 hours and spend the rest of the week, you know, in bed. And that's really hard, to sort of not be able to take pleasure in the world in these really simple ways that I think all of us who are able-bodied take for granted.
Right. And so how do you carry on? I mean, there's some dark moments in your movie where you talk about this is not really life. This is sort of a shadow of a life. What is the hope that keeps you going?
I mean, for me, what keeps me going is the art. It's being a filmmaker, and it is having the opportunity to share the story and build community and build and grow a movement. And, you know, I also think that for us, the most important thing in our relationship is that we support each other and that we love each other and that we can talk to each other and share our ideas, and that, you know, that hasn't been taken away. You know, we still have each other. And I think that's what makes it possible to live with this and to still have a good life. Mm.
And so you connected through social media with all these other sufferers of this disease, victims of this disease. And I mean, I think it's remarkable that everyone is, well, hidden in a way, and you're trying to connect and make it very, very visible. And this is a disease that is particularly hidden away because people can't leave their homes by and large, or many of them can't, or not for a long period of time. And so I guess that's part of it, that people are literally forgotten because no one can see them. And so do you think that it, through this technology, through connecting through FaceTime and through internet technology, that this will be able to make the movement more visible and make people who suffer from chronic fatigue actually visible to the rest of the world?
I think social media has and is changing everything. I think, you know, firstly, it's made us visible to each other.
Yeah, I'm completely bedridden. I've lost the ability to walk.
I crawl from my bed to my bathroom, and I just think, this is my life.
It's the cognitive problems that are the most disabling.
I live in a dark room 24/7.
I think there were many people who, you know, would have gotten sick with this, you know, 20 years ago and might not have ever gotten diagnosed. I know people who have been sick for decades and are just now getting diagnosed, you know, in part because of the film. And so it's sort of, it's allowing us to kind of find each other. And so I think that is, you know, going to be a part of what helps us to create the change that we're fighting for.
What are you fighting for? What's the change?
So right now, essentially for decades, the NIH has only invested about, on average, about $5 or $6 million a year in researching this disease. And to give you some sense of perspective, you know, we invest more in studying hay fever. Given that this disease affects 1 million Americans and is, on average, more disabling than multiple sclerosis, we should be getting roughly $250 million a year. That would be parity to other similarly disabling diseases. I think, you know, I firmly believe that if I had gotten diagnosed early, I would never have gotten as sick as I eventually got. That first year, I was pretty functional. You know, my disability was, if I go skiing with my family, I can ski for a day, but not three. But I could still exercise at a lower level and was doing pretty well. But I had no idea what was wrong. And every time I went to a doctor, I was told, you're fine, just keep going on with your life. And if I had been told to rest and be careful, and if I'd understood that I had a limit that I needed to respect, I think it would have made all the difference in terms of giving me the possibility of recovery. And so I think early diagnosis could make such a huge difference for patients, and that requires medical education. But right now, you know, the disease is not even taught in about, you know, 96% of medical schools.
Is there a possibility for recovery?
I think definitely, yes. I mean, I'm hopeful, and I know that there are people who sometimes do recover, even if they've been sick for 5 or 10 years, and no one knows why. And so I think that if we had treatments, we could at least get people to a much higher level of function. And I personally believe that we could get to a point where we could take, you know, millions of people and restore them back to their lives.
So we did this interview with a tape syncer, someone who's with you in your house, because it was too difficult for you to come to the studio. So I want to thank you so much for this interview and for taking the time and using your energy, your limited energy for this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Brea. She's the director of the new documentary, Unrest. The film premieres this Friday, and you can see it here in L.A. at Lemley's Monica Film Center and Playhouse 7. Coming up on the program, the origins of the Star Spangled Banner and how it illustrates our slave-owning past. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand with the tune that's getting a lot of attention right now. Rockets' red glare, bombs bursting in air. It's not the national anthem itself that's generating controversy. It's what's happening during the singing of the anthem. NFL players taking a knee to protest police brutality. But maybe the anthem itself is worth some discussion. At least that's what professor and journalist Jason Johnson suggests. Because listen to this, the third verse of the Star Spangled Banner.
Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps, pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave.
Okay, did you catch the lyrics there at the end? Just in case, this is what it says. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. Jason Johnson, politics editor at The Root and professor at Morgan State University in Baltimore, is here with us to talk about that. Hi.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Okay, explain those lines. What are they referring to?
Well, basically, it's a reference to the colonial Marines. Francis Scott Key, who is the author of the Star-Spangled Banner, he had been in the military, and he had been in a battle against colonial Marines, and they were actually a collection of freed black men and a lot of runaway slaves who joined the British in exchange for freedom.
And this is during the War of 1812, right?
Yes, this is during the War of 1812, and basically, they had beaten Francis Scott Key. He was embarrassed. He lost to a group of colonial Marines at the Battle of Bladensburg. And so later on, when he was on a British ship begging for one of his friends to be taken from being captive, he said, hey, you know, I'm going to write this song and I'm going to express my joy and my happiness and my hope for the United States. And I'm going to express my anger at the black men who beat me, who I was hoping to, you know, keep enslaved in the United States of America. So there's a lot of things in the song that are extremely problematic. And I don't think that should be lost in our sort of larger conversation about racial equality and what people really want to take a knee for.
Mm. Okay, so basically he's saying these former slaves who beat me well, no refuge can save them from the gloom of the grave, meaning we beat them.
Yes. Well,
basically
meaning,
bragging.
Yeah. Well, his hope is, you know, the blood of the hireling, right? And so the hirelings were not only sort of mercenaries, but also that was a sort of pejorative way of talking about former slaves who had become colonial marines. So the blood of the hireling will wash away the British stain, et cetera, et cetera. So he's basically saying, look, at the Battle of Fort McHenry, which is what he was looking at the time, I hope that we kill many of these former black slaves who are working for the British, because their betrayal, having the audacity to seek freedom, is greater than anything else that we're facing with the British, and I hope that their blood washes away the British stain. So there's a lot of hostility, a lot of bigotry, a lot of anger there, but he wasn't atypical for the time. And that additional lyric was pretty much sung with the Star-Spangled Banner right up until the 1930s and 40s.
Mm. Well, it became a national anthem in 1931. We don't sing that third verse anymore,
no, we don't.
Right?
No, we don't. In fact, most people were completely unaware of it. I'm here at Morgan State University. A group of students put together a documentary because we're near, you know, Fort McHenry, the Battle of Bladensburg. All these things happened in the Baltimore, Maryland area. And they did some research on that third lyric. And it was more or less dropped around the 1940s, 1950s. But again, it's still there. It hasn't been taken out. And to be honest, just like discussions about slave owners who are, you know, who have their names on college buildings and things like that, if America wants to have an honest accounting of its own history, these sorts of things need to be discussed. The light needs to be brought to them, and we need to have real conversations about whether or not they should play a role in the America that we live in today.
Do you think we should take it out? It should be expunged.
You know, but see, this is the thing. I'm not. I'm a political scientist, not a historian. I don't have a sort of nostalgic love for the past. If something no longer fits where we are as a country, then fine. We can keep it in the history books, but it's not something that we have to praise, and it's not something that, you know, a bunch of NFL teams have to take money from the Department of Defense from in order to sing before a game.
Okay, but given the fact that nobody sings it and very few people actually know about it, how do you think it does relate to this current controversy with the NFL and kneeling?
Well, I think it's this sort of larger idea that there are racial undercurrents to things that even are discussed as race neutral. So, for example, yes, playing a sport in and of itself may be a race-neutral activity, but who owns that sport? Who puts it together is an issue. Yes, violence by police is problematic regardless. It's 2 weeks ago we saw the video of a cop harassing and abusing a nurse up in Utah. All those people were white. Police brutality happens to people of all colors, but it disproportionately affects African Americans. It disproportionately results in death for African Americans. So in the same way, you know, yes, the Star-Spangled Banner may be a generally neutral song, but if the undercurrent, if any undercurrent, has to do with the oppression and the abuse and the marginalization of people of color, that should no longer be a part of our body politic, certainly not something sung in celebration.
Okay. Any suggestions for national anthem alternatives?
I have always liked Living in America by James Brown. and I saw it as a kid, like when he comes out singing, I think it's like Rocky III, when he comes out and Rocky's got like the pants on that are in like the stars and stripes and everything else like that. I always loved it. So if you can get somebody to sing like the James Brown version of Living in America, I think that should start every game in every sport.
Okay, thanks a lot. Jason Johnson, politics editor at The Root, professor at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Thanks, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's not James Brown, but it is the theme for feedback.
It is.
And that means Christian Bordahl is here. Hi there.
Hi. So you talked earlier about the $200 million given to UC Irvine by a couple who are strong supporters of homeopathy.
Uh-huh.
So I reached out to our listeners to see what they think, and I put up a little poll, and 36% of them so far say it works for me, 64% say it's quackery. So that's what the listeners are saying, which kind of surprised me because I thought more people might be supportive of homeopathy. But anyway, a lot of people saying, you know, One of them said, I take turmeric twice a day for my back. No idea if it works. I take it alongside ibuprofen. So I think many people just sort of hedge their bets when it comes to these things.
Right, exactly. How could it hurt? That's what a lot of people say. Although some doctors say, look, you know, it could hurt. You know, you could have like medicines that counterindicate or whatever that
is. I guess, but not homeopathy because there's not really.
There's nothing in it. Right. Okay. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.